Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? Brad Williams fronts Arkansas' premier feel-good country band, the Salty Dogs, whose music has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces and HBO's Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, the first of our two End Hate shows, where LGBT Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Best Impressions Restaurant in the Arkansas Arts Center in Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Stonewall Democratic Caucus. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here playing for us tonight is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark can be heard on blues legend John Weston's CDs, Blues at Daybreak and Got to Deal with the Blues. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here tonight? Y'all like our set? Tonight, we are thrilled to feature esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox's new series, End Hate, a conceptual art project based on the labels once placed on doors not that long ago from our shameful past. Our listeners can find out more about the End Hate project and V.L. at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's show is part one of our two-part End Hate series, with the goal of bringing people together and ending hate and discrimination. Because when we tell and listen to each other's stories, we discover we're not so different after all. All stories are true and told by the LGBT Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Tippi McCullough gets a surprise proposal, and we'll end the night with Zeke Taylor breaking a law in the South. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Randy Romo in a tree being herself in Tree Climber.
"What are you doing?" asked my little brother Jimmy. "Go away," I replied. "You're going to climb that tree, aren't you?" "No, I'm just going to sit under it." "I want to climb the tree too. You're too little. It's only for big kids. I'm telling Mama." Jimmy's last threat got my attention. At 13, I was my mother's oldest out of six children and the only girl. That meant she could devote her full attention to ensuring that I developed into a proper model of femininity. Of course, this meant no tree climbing, no wrestling, no football, and no baseball. In short, I wasn't allowed to do anything I considered to be fun. Well, at least nothing that my mom knew about. I actually did all of those things and more, and I was good at it too, usually besting all of the neighborhood boys. I hated the limitations my mom imposed on me, the gender roles she locked me into just because I was a girl. I loved climbing trees, getting as high into the canopy as I could and riding up there in the sky while the wind rustled the leaves, escaping for a brief time the world below. Our granny's house had the best climbing tree that ever pushed its way out of an acorn. Its limbs were strong, not too big and not too little, and they were spaced just so all the way up. There was a perfect starter limb that I could catch hold of to swing myself up and begin to climb. Once I got as high as I could go, there was a natural cradle where I could sit and read. For all of its perfection, though, it had one major drawback. It was right outside the dining room window where Granny, my mom, and whatever aunts who happened to be there that day would congregate. Not to be deterred, I would sneak around to the back side of the tree and stealthily and quickly creep my way up into its branches. This is where I was one Saturday afternoon during the weekly visit to see Granny, easing my way around to get up in that wondrous tree. I had a book and a couple of ham biscuits wrapped in a napkin tied to my belt loop, ready to make my escape from life on the ground up in one of my secret tree excursions. Now, when you're the only girl with a whole bunch of little brothers, you find that they often show up just where and exactly when they are least wanted. And so it was that day. Just as I reached for the first limb, my little brother Jimmy appeared. "I'm telling Mama," as siblings have done from the beginning of time, we argued back and forth. Finally, in desperation, I pretended to give up on the tree and headed over to the big front porch. I sat in the glider and took out my book and started reading. Bored, Jimmy gave up and wandered off. Or so I thought. I tied my book back onto my belt and lit out for the tree as quickly as I could. I was about halfway up when I heard a sound below. There he was, following me up into the tree. I was mad. How dare Jimmy intrude on my secret place, and how dare he risk getting us both caught? I could hear the women's voices floating up from the dining room's open window. "Get down," I whispered furiously. "No, I want to climb too. Go away, you're going to get us in trouble. No, I'll tell on you if you make me get down." As I looked down at him with my most ferocious scowl, I could see he was just as determined to climb that tree as I was for him to get out of it. Clearly, I wasn't going to be able to force him back down. Resigned, I continued climbing, with Jimmy steadily making his own way up behind me. "Sissy! Crash! Womp!" I scrambled down out of the tree as fast as I could, ripping my shorts and scratching myself on the branches from head to toe, creating indisputable evidence that I had been where I ought not to be. Jimmy lay on his back, sprawled out, not making a sound. He'd hit the ground so hard it knocked the wind out of him. His eyes were huge and filled with tears. I could see him gulping and heaving to try and catch his breath. I scooped his head into my lap and rubbed his chest, all the while desperately begging him not to holler for Mama. Finally, his breath caught. He sucked in a good lungful and began to wail. "Mama!" The dining room chair scraped across the floor as the women jumped up to answer the call. In seconds, the screen door slammed a staccato beat as Mama and company came tearing around to the side yard. Mama lifted Jimmy up in her arms, demanding an explanation from me, because clearly, in my disheveled state, all scratched up and with torn shorts, I was culpable somehow. I stammered out the least damning version I could think of, but it was clear I'd be hearing more from her later about my violation of her proper behavior standards. And I did. In addition to getting a good whipping for leading my brothers astray and getting him hurt, I also endured a long lecture about how unladylike I was. My tomboy ways were going to be the death of her yet. Shaking her finger at me as she finally wound down, she made one last parting shot. "You know, if you keep up these kind of ways, no man is going to have you. You're never going to find a good husband. Then what's going to happen to you?" Now, my inside voice had a lot to say about that. "Well, that's fine with me. I don't want a husband anyway." But as usual, I stood silently waiting for it to be over. I loved my mom, and I wanted to be a good daughter, but I didn't want to be confined to her script of what that meant. And it was around this time that I finally figured out why I felt different from a lot of other kids. It actually had a name. I read the word lesbian in one of my books and understood that it meant me. Somehow I knew this was a thing I could not give voice to, that these were feelings my friends clearly did not have for other girls. They clamored on about the cute boys, and all I could think of was my desire for a girlfriend. For as long as I could remember, I wanted to wear the clothing that the gender police decided were only for boys. I hated dresses. And more than just about anything, I wanted a tuxedo just like the one James Bond wore. And no, I didn't want to be a boy. I was perfectly happy with the body I had. I just wanted to wear the clothing that felt more natural and comfortable to me. I wanted the freedom that the boys seemed to have just because they were boys, the freedom to climb any tree I wanted, the freedom to grow up and have a wife. I struggled mightily with my mother's gender and religious-based expectations and my own growing realization of my sexual orientation. As the burden of my secret grew heavier, I found myself drawn to ways to self-medicate the pain. I was so miserable, so very lonely, and so afraid. I fell in with a group of other misfits at school, and I started getting high. Then one day, I overdosed. I awoke in the hospital to face a barrage of questioning. Why did you do it? What's going on with you? Do you have any idea what this is doing to your poor mother? I had no answers. I hadn't meant to overdose. I wasn't trying to kill myself. I didn't think. How could I tell them out loud that I was a lesbian? That my mom was expecting so much of me that was not me? That I was terrified of anyone finding out? Aside from my overwhelming fear, I had no clue what it would mean for the rest of my life, this knowledge that I was gay. After a few days of my continued silence, during which a revolving cast of doctors and social workers inundated me with endless interviews, I was taken before a judge. He asked me a few questions that I neither understood nor had answers for. I had no idea what any of this meant. My mom and stepdad sat in the back of the room. My mom cried. The judge issued an order designating me mentally incompetent and remanding me against my will to a state mental hospital. At 13, I was the youngest person there. The next oldest patient was in her mid-20s. For the next 2 years, this place became the living manifestation of hell in my young life. I hadn't meant to kill myself with the overdose, but in that place, I came to wish that I had succeeded. In the chaotic, broken years afterward, I fell down into a rabbit hole of despair. I wandered in search of a promised land, but could find no shore upon which to rest. During this time, I did try to commit suicide, and much to my eventual everlasting joy, I failed. It took time, a lot of time. Many more years would pass before I learned how to embrace myself, to be proud of all of who I am. But I did. It would take longer still for Mom and me to reconcile. But we too at long last found our way. And yeah, I finally did get to rock that tuxedo.
Randy M. Romo is a human being with a multiplicity of identities that create said Romo. Mexican-American, queer, daughter, parent, grandparent, writer, artist, activist, adventurer, with only a small carry-on for baggage. Next on Tales from the South, Tippi McCullough and her partner do something they never thought possible in Split-Tailed Girls, Chocolate Gravy, and Walter White.
Barbara, my partner of 14 years, and I were in Lake Tahoe for me to attend a teaching workshop when we heard the news. The Supreme Court of the United States had decided marriage between two women was federally recognized. Honestly, Barbara and I had never entertained the thought of marriage. That was just something straight people did. We told ourselves we didn't need marriage. But suddenly, at that moment, we were beaming. Something was happening we never imagined would in our lifetime. Acknowledgement. It felt different somehow. As we walked around the beautiful lake, Barbara actually broached the subject, and I jokingly asked, "Are you proposing?" "If you are, I accept." No down on your knees, no ring in a dessert, just smiles and the contemplation of it all. Being gay in the South had been a tightrope walk for me my whole life. Actually, I always felt encouraged to become a good actor, or liar in a sense. Y'all have heard those gay lies. This is my friend, my roommate, my sister, my cousin. Or No, I'm not married or have a boyfriend. I just went through a bad breakup and am taking a break from dating. Or my favorite, I don't date coworkers or men related to coworkers. It has ended badly in the past. Then I was constantly dealing with all the code words for gay here in the South. My grandmother more than once cautioned me about running around with those split-tailed girls. I never once heard my grandmother say the word lesbian, and she absolutely loved my wife, Barbara. A LGBT person navigates lots of code here in the South where everyone knows, but no one talks about it. When we arrived back in Arkansas after that fateful weekend, we were surprised to discover how excited our straight friends were, and they encouraged us to get married. We had both come from small families where our moms had divorced and remarried numerous times and had convinced ourselves we weren't missing out on anything special. But as people continued to ask and show their excitement, we decided to act. We would get hitched in New Mexico. We chose New Mexico because marriage was legal there, unlike our beloved home state, and we would pass through New Mexico on our way to a previously planned Grand Canyon vacation. Then everyone started asking us about being registered, rings, receptions, vows, and about all the traditions that go along with a wedding. We were still trying to absorb it all. Oh, dear God, what would we call each other? Wife? Spouse? We decided on neither because being good Southern girls, we didn't want to make anyone uncomfortable, especially ourselves. The romance of it all was overwhelming. We would be married around 8:15 a.m. after driving for 18 hours in the judge's courtroom with her clerk and our two friends who were making the trip with us, our best woman and maid of honor, Whitney and Aubrey. We pulled into Albuquerque, went into a restaurant, changed clothes, ate pancakes instead of wedding cake, and left in time to go obtain our marriage license. We didn't learn that the clerk's office was 3 blocks from the courthouse until we purchased our license, and then we ran. I mean, hightailed it. All 4 of us to the courthouse. We knew the judge had an 8:30 a.m. docket, and we were worried she would change her mind if we held her up. Finally, the moment was at hand. The judge and her clerk led us to the ceremonial courtroom, which was beautiful and new, and she told us this would be her first marriage performance. Well, we were all newbies. We all took our places, and the weight of the moment began taking its toll. As the judge read the beautiful vows, Barbara did something very out of character for her. She began to cry. I began to cry. And I'm not talking a few tears drifting down our cheeks. I'm talking sob cry. Shaking uncontrollably cry. Ugly cry. The crying spread. The judge was crying. Aubrey and Whitney were crying. And the judge's clerk was crying. The judge paused and said, "We all have got to get a hold of ourselves." We managed to pull it together and finished the ceremony, signed everything, and thanked everyone. We were officially wife and wife. We all walked back to the car laughing and hugging. As we jubilantly tumbled into our car to continue on to the Grand Canyon, my phone rang. It was a coworker from my private school. I thought maybe they had a question about lesson plans I'd left, so I answered. She immediately asked me if Barbara and I were getting married while gone. I said, "Why do you ask?" She told me that if I married Barbara, I was fired. I hung up the phone in shock. Everyone in the car looked at me with so much joy in their eyes and asked, "What was that all about?" And I burst into tears. So what was one of the happiest days of my life had suddenly turned into the worst. As we drove to Walter White's house from the show Breaking Bad for a photo op, I sobbed. Our best woman, Whitney, who is a Breaking Bad freak, said, "It's really no big deal. Let's just skip Walter's house." I sobbed, no, I refuse to let them ruin that also. So off we went to Walter's house. Everyone piled out. It was not the fun moment we had envisioned. I was bawling and Barb was distraught, but through my tears, I counted to three, they faked a fun, happy pose, and I snapped the fake happy moment. As I drove onto Flagstaff, the realization that I lost my job of 14 years was almost unbearable. Between the altitude and crying, I felt like my head might explode the next morning. Everyone else sees their sorrows with a lot of help from a lot of whiskey, and their heads were also exploding in the morning. Soon, I would have no check coming in, no insurance, no retirement plan, and I felt my identity slowly slipping away. Then the first and only openly gay elected legislator in Arkansas, Kathy Webb, called and told Barbara and me we had two choices: stand and fight or slink back to the closet in shame. We decided to stand and fight, and we have never regretted that decision. Was it hard? Unbelievably so. In a span of 3 months, I had turned 50, been fired, outed statewide and nationally, caught the flu, completely lost my confidence to teach, and couldn't eat. And let me tell you, at no point in my life have I ever been unable to eat. I'm talking not even my grandmother's homemade chocolate gravy and biscuits. But I somehow pulled through with Barbara pulling and pushing the whole way. I now work at Central High School, and I'm honored to be working at this wonderfully diverse school, which is the very place of the epic historic struggle of equality in Arkansas. Central High School is not just a place of equality, but actually practices what they preach. We are all equal. At Central, they put Barb and myself on the cover of the Valentine's Day issue of the school newspaper and wrote an article about us and our struggle for all the students to see. I was finally in a place that not only felt like home, but was home. I became just another part of the huge diverse culture that is Central High School. One day, one of my students asked, "Ms. McCullough, was that your wife on the cover of the school paper with you?" I held my breath and answered, "Yes," and continued with my teaching, and no one blinked an eye. Do Barbara and I still fall into the default mode of leading the double life? Yes, because it's ingrained in us from years of performing. Is it liberating to be able to say, "This is my wife, Barbara"? You're dang right it is. I'm a proud Southerner and a proud Arkansan, and will continue to hope and work endlessly for a day when this great Southern state will recognize that everyone is equal.
Tippi McCullough is from Hot Springs, Arkansas. She has taught English for 30 years and counting. She currently teaches at the historic Central High School. She and her wife, Barbara, live in Little Rock. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, let's go on a date with Zeke Taylor in Memphis in the 1970s in Dancing in the Dark.
I spent a great deal of time picking out just the right outfit to wear for my date with Dick. It was May in Memphis, the weather was perfect, and it was Saturday night. I selected clothes that I thought were tight enough to be sexy, but were loose enough for juking. As I did every Saturday night, I put on my slick-soled shoes that were best suited for sliding around on a dance floor. During the week, I wore work boots during the colder months and wore sandals or went barefoot in the spring and summer. I saved my slick-soled shoes for Saturday night. I didn't want to wear them out with everyday use. They were for dancing. Dick and I spent most evenings together just hanging out, going to the movies, or driving down to the Mississippi River levee, one of our favorite romantic places, where we would sit and watch the lights on the water of the wide river from the barges going by at night. However, Saturday night was our special night, the one night of the week when we could kick up our heels and go dancing. On this particular Saturday night, I was very happy and ready to celebrate because I had just finished the spring semester as a student at the Memphis College of Art. I loved to dance. At an early age, while growing up in the Arkansas Delta, my parents saw to it that my sisters and I had dance lessons. My father told us, "You need to know how to dance so you won't be socially handicapped when you go to college." As a teen, I danced with my sister and her girlfriends. We drove all over Northeast Arkansas, to go to teen dances, and I was always the first to demonstrate the latest dances of the day that included the twist, the mashed potato, and the hully gully. I never dreamed that one day I would be dancing with a man. It was not socially acceptable in the 1970s for two men to dance together. It was so taboo that when I lived in Memphis in the 70s, it was actually illegal for two men to dance together. Arrests did take place. Four male couples were arrested for dancing in a bar, and the arrests were reported in the Memphis Commercial Appeal newspaper. I thought, how horrible for those men to be so publicly shamed. Dick picked me up around 9 on that Saturday night in his partially restored black 48 Chevy pickup truck, and we drove to a bar called the Psych Out on North Cleveland in Memphis. The bar was a special place for us. It is where we had met a few months earlier. It was one of four gay bars in Memphis and was the place for young men to be seen, to meet, and to dance. The bar, like most gay bars during that time, was not in the best part of town. It was windowless to prevent prying eyes from peering in. Even though at times we were a little frightened while going from the car to the door, danger was not going to keep us from having fun. When we entered the bar that night, it was already packed. The bar's red lights illuminated the smoke hanging in the air, creating a crimson fog. Everyone smoked cigarettes back then, me included. I had a long red cigarette holder that I used on occasion that looked mighty fine holding a long Salem cigarette. I had the holder with me that night because I thought it perfectly complemented the black and red floral shirt I was wearing. Dick went to the bar and got a Miller for him and ordered me my usual, a whiskey sour. He always paid for our drinks. I was a struggling art student on a tight budget, while he held a steady job as a bookkeeper at an auto parts store and made a whopping $127.50 working a 44-hour week. I felt very fortunate to be dating a handsome and well-scrubbed, successful working man. On that lovely May night, after we entered the bar, we sat at a table with some friends who came from out of town. The Psych Out was one of the few gay bars in the Mid-South, and there were always guys there from the adjoining states of Arkansas and Mississippi. The bar was the place for at least once a week. Many of those men could be free to be themselves. On that night, just like Cinderella, we all sat there waiting for midnight. However, unlike the Cinderella story, that's when our ball would begin and we could dance. It was the law that bars in Tennessee had to close at midnight on Saturdays, since Sunday was a holy day. However, no one left the Psych Out at closing time on Saturdays. At the stroke of midnight, the doors were locked, the tables were cleared from the center of the floor, and we would have a private dance party. The cops were aware of what was happening inside the bar and would periodically show up. The bar owner kept a lookout on duty in the parking lot, and if the cops pulled into the lot, lights inside the bar would flicker on and off, and everyone would stop dancing. By the time the cops were let in, everyone was seated and indulging in casual conversation. The cops could not force us to leave as we were there under the guise of having a private party. Except for their menacing appearance, they really didn't harass anyone. They just walked through the bar, never smiling, staring at certain people, and eventually exiting. After the cops left, the lights were dimmed, the music resumed, and everyone once again danced. At 11:30 that night, our waiter, Little Larry, came by, and with a wink, told us it was last call. We got a couple more drinks. When Little Larry returned with the beverages, as I always did, I stared at his right hand. The hand was missing the little finger that had been shut off during a robbery in the bar. The robber was hiding above the suspended ceiling, fell through, his gun discharged, and shot off Little Larry's finger. My only regret was that I had not been there the night of the robbery and missed the excitement. Finally, it was midnight, and the dancing began. One very popular song of the time was Miss American Pie. Sometime during that night, the DJ played that song, and something magical happened. Everyone in the bar stood up, placed arms over shoulders, and formed a huge circle. The circle, with up to 40 guys in formation, went round and round in the bar with everyone singing. We whirled around that bar for the entire length of the 8-minute song, locked together, dripping with sweat, laughing and having a great time. We were young and reckless and enjoying an activity that was perhaps made more exciting because it was illegal. We were brothers, arm in arm, sharing a secret that involved more than dancing. While the sergeants played a marching tune, we all got up to dance. We danced all night long. At dawn, we left the bar, tired and happy, and several of us went to the Omen Inn, a diner on Union Avenue, for breakfast. While swilling down coffee and eating omelets, we made plans to do it again the following weekend. We hugged, said our goodbyes, and Dick and I, exhausted, went to my apartment where we slept until afternoon. 43 years later, Dick and I are still together, and we still love to dance. He still drinks Miller Lite, and I still drink whiskey, even though it's no longer illegal for us to dance together. In most situations, it's still not socially acceptable. In some places, it could even be dangerous. However, when we hear American Pie, no matter where we are taken back to that magical night in Memphis, and once again, we dance. They were singing, "Bye Bye, Miss American Pie." Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye and singing, "This'll be the day that I die."
Watercolor Zeke Taylor is a recipient of the Arkansas Governor's Arts Award for Lifetime Achievement. He and his partner of 43 years married this past May and were the first male couple to be married in any southern state. So how about our stories and LGBT storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at Best Impressions Restaurant in the Arkansas Arts Center. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops. And tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Stonewall Democratic Caucus. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Times, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Once knew a man who loved too much. His heart was brittle, but soft to the touch. And he cried, and he cried, and he tried to keep his thoughts. Thoughts to himself, though he never did speak. I once knew a man who continually prayed all the love and for his as others to stay. And he cried, and he tried, and he tried to keep his thoughts to himself, but we never did speak. Keep his thoughts to himself, though we never did speak. Keep his thoughts to himself, though he never did keep his thoughts to himself, though he never did speak. Well, take this beating from my chest, curse the air that I breathe, and curse all the salt that's dripping down my cheek. Blessed be that day your face I will see. Blessed be the day your face I will see.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in Person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.